Hello and welcome, Dreamers, to another episode of Dreamcast Years. This one being a very special one, because it's not one of the regular episodes, as it were, but it is a Winterfest special, and it's a crossover, which I don't think we've done on Dreamcast Years, but we have done with the Dreamcast Junkyard, which are exactly the people who are joining us today. So Dreamcast Years have done crossovers with the Dreamcast Junkyard, DreamPod, and this time they're coming this way. I'm getting confused already. This is Dreamcast Years, and we've got Dreamcast Junkyard people on it as a bit of a joint Winterfest special. So let me introduce everybody before we get started, and maybe that will clarify things. So from the Dreamcast Years side, of course, you've got me, Andrew, your host, and you also have Steve. Hello, Steve.
Hello, hello, hello.
Hello. And we have Jason. Hi, Jason.
Hello, hello. How are you?
Hello. Fortunately, we don't have Rich this time because he's not feeling too well. So sending all of our
get
best
well
wishes
soon,
to
Rich.
Yes, indeed. And joining us from the Dreamcast Junkyard's DreamPod, we have three lovely people. We have James. How's it going, James?
Hello, I have mulled wine, which is very appropriate for the festive edition of this podcast. So hello, hello, hello.
It is very, very, very good. Good bit of mulled wine. Lewis, we have you too. Do you have any mulled wine there?
No, I have water, and seeing as this is the time of Jesus, maybe he will come along and make it into wine. So fingers crossed.
Cheapskate.
Okay. Let us know by the end of the episode if that is indeed now wine.
Yeah.
It would be hilarious if he did come back and that was the only thing he did. Yeah, just for you specifically.
Mm-hmm. It's my birthday soon, so you never know.
Well,
yeah, fair. And we also have Brian. How's it going, Brian?
Good. How are you, Andrew?
Very good, thank you. Very good. Oh. What do you have to drink? Do you have water as well?
No, I just got coffee. I haven't switched to liquor yet, so
okay.
Working on it, but it's still only around lunchtime here, so
yeah,
still trying to get that energy up.
By the end of the podcast, maybe you'll have reached for the hard stuff. We'll see how it goes.
Oh yeah. No, I think as this goes, there more and more bourbon will find its way into the coffee or whiskey or yeah, something. Something's going in there.
Okay, cool. Well, we'll see how drunk you are by the end of the episode. I'm just on good old water. Steve, Jason, what are you drinking?
I'm also on water, yes. Although I have no hopes of that being turned into anything more fun by the end of this.
Yeah.
I'm taking Rich's mantle for wacky beers tonight, and I have a layer cake, which is a marshmallow and chocolate stout.
Okay. Awesome. Daniel Craig in there as well? Or?
It's very, very, very nice. What was that, Andrew? Sorry?
Is Daniel Craig in there as well?
I hope not.
is that one of the Omnipollo varieties or Omnipollo? I'm not sure how to pronounce it.
No, it's not that fancy, unfortunately. Wow. It's a brew dog.
Oh, nice.
I had it last year and it was... As soon as I had it, I was like, this is one of my favorite beers ever. And it still is today.
Awesome. Yeah, I took some of Rich's suggestions after the last crossover podcast where he talked about some of the maple pancake flavored ones that other brewery puts out. And oh my gosh, they're delicious. And yeah, I was pretty excited to be able to find them here in Seattle. We have a pretty good selection of both local, a lot of breweries here, but a good import scene as well. So.
Reasonably priced?
No. Yeah, it was like probably like $13 for a pint.
That sounds about right. Yeah.
Yeah, that's all part of the craft beer experience.
Yeah.
Totally.
Well, there we go. We're all drinking some stuff. Whoever's listening, hopefully you've got something good to drink. If you don't, you've got time to go grab one. You can pause this. Unless you're listening on Radio Sega Live. I say live in inverted commas. But as it airs, as it were, because, of course, this is the Winterfest episode. So hello to all of our Radio Sega listeners. Thank you very much for joining us for another Winterfest edition. I hope you've all been enjoying Winterfest so far. If you're listening to this sometime in the future and it's not winter, this originally aired in winter. So that's why it's Winterfest. Just self-explanatory, really, isn't it? What we're going to do, as we always do, we do something obviously very Sega-related. I mean, we're called the Dreamcast Years, right? But we very rarely talk about Sega, much to everybody's chagrin. Is that how you say it? over on the Discord. There's taken the mick out of a little bit the fact that we very rarely mention any Sega games on the Dreamcast years, but you know, it's just how it is. It's just the way the cookie crumbles.
I mean, it's called Dreamcast years, right? It's about the years.
It is.
But doesn't it go past said years?
Shh. We don't mention that.
I bring logic into this.
Don't kick
we
me
just
off.
Kept adding years. It's just, you know, it's like, oh, we'll talk about that year as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's just multiple years is all you're committing to, you know.
Yeah.
You don't have to. Yeah, you can change that benchmark.
Exactly, and we have multiple times, but I have promised I won't change anymore, so we're set in our years now.
It's just the years in between Dreamcast 1 and the inevitable Dreamcast 2 anyway, if you think you about it, so,
yep,
you
know. There you go.
I mean, don't set that wild fan base off. It's almost as bad as the Sonic fan base, I say on Radio Sega. Hi, Sonic fans! I'm kidding. I'm very excited for Sonic Frontier. All right, so what are we here for today? What is this episode all about? Well, because we've got our Dreamcast Junkyard compatriots on, it is all about the Dreamcast this time, of course. So we are very much Sega focused. Yay. And we're going to be doing a Game of the Year style episode. So those of you who listen to the Dreamcast Years podcast will know that we do a Game of the Year style thing where each person will pitch their favorite game from that particular year. In a minute, we discuss it and then we put it up for a vote. But this time, rather than just being one particular year, it's going to be the Dreamcast years, which is confusing considering we've just discussed how many years that is for us. But the actual Dreamcast years, so the years that the Dreamcast was actually on the market, we're going to be picking our favourite game from the Dreamcast from that time and pitching it and then having a bit of a discussion. And we'll also be picking a track, a musical track from that particular game, since we're on Radio Sega and it's Winterfest. We thought we had to get something musical in there. So that's what we'll be doing. And then I think my plan is that we're going to do a bit of a vote on Twitter after this goes live. And I reckon we'll do Dreamcast Junkyard versus Dreamcast Years and then whittle it down to one game per podcast and then pitch those two games against each other. I think that's fair, right?
Mm-hmm.
Sounds good.
Yeah. So there'll be some votes. There'll be a couple of polls coming up. At the end of this episode, I'm going to do my usual wizardry and put the polls up while this is playing live on Radio Sega. So you'll be able to start voting and then we'll go from there. And I'm sure we'll probably have a bit of a discussion at the end of this as to what we think is the best of these choices. I think we should get started if everybody's ready.
Let's do
ready
it.
As I'll ever be.
Yep.
All right. Should we record like multiple versions of this as alternate realities depending on how the poll goes? We can just insert in our different commentary to adapt to each. It's a little too fancy.
Probably too fancy. It's way too fancy.
It'd be awesome though, right?
It would be, no? Right? Yeah, it would be great. But
it would be great, but Andrew can't be bothered, so we're not gonna do it. <Really can't. laughs>
Oh dear. If anybody else was editing it, the lovely RJJ software has done some editing for us recently, but unfortunately they're on Christmas break, so I have to edit this. So anything overly fancy is just not on the agenda, unfortunately. We'll just have a regular chat, and we can always reconvene later to discuss the winner, perhaps maybe at a later date. Might be fun. But yeah. All right. I think I'm going to go with the Dreamcast Junkyard first, with the DreamPod host, and Lewis, I feel like I want to come to you first for your pitch. How does that sound? Are you ready?
Yep, I wrote it an hour ago, so
okay. Remember, this has to fit in a minute, so I will cut you off if you go beyond the minute.
Yeah, you can't do what I did on the last game of the year and just carry on ignoring the call and just carry on.
Yeah.
I mean, you can do that, because when Jason did it, we didn't do anything about it. He just kept going. So
that's right. I had important stuff to say.
Yeah, it's true, you did.
This is all coming off your time, boys, so you keep going.
I set a timer on my phone? Presumably.
I've got a timer here. I will tell you when the time is up. You could just fluff it. You could pretend it's been a minute, Lewis. We would never know. So I'm gonna count you in. Are you ready?
Okay.
All right. Your time starts.
Do I introduce my pitch first, though?
Oh, yes, of course you do. What are you pitching for us, Lewis?
I am pitching Shenmue 2.
Interesting. Okay. Mm-hmm. I can already tell. I can already feel the looks from one particular person. I'm going to count you in. So your time, Lewis, to pitch starts in 3, 2, 1, go.
Okay, so Shenmue 2 is everything that you loved about the first, just amped up to 11. While attention to detail is slighter in this and traded in favour of Expanse, this is arguably the biggest game to ever hit the Dreamcast. Environments are varied, massive and bustling. All the new characters are charming, and it's also the game that introduced Lucky Hit, so how can you hate it, really? Greatest moment of this game comes on Disc 4, where Ryo meets the girl of his dreams, literally, Shenhua. What follows is what I'd argue is the blueprint of all modern story-based games. Ryo walks with Shenhua on his way to Guilin, conversing with her on selecting various topics. This is where you see Ryo open up and actually talk to someone instead of just being a sociopath. The beautiful music combined with the conversation makes this a moment in games that will stick with me forever. So yeah, thank you, Yu Suzuki, and yeah, probably my favorite game in this trilogy. So yep, there you go. Time
is up. Yeah, that was incredibly well timed, Lewis.
Thanks.
Did you like rehearse this beforehand?
I missed out like 3 lines of what I'd written.
Oh dear. No, I think that's probably the most well timed pitch we had. Didn't we do like a forfeit once where we asked, I think it was Rich, to try and get as close to a minute as possible?
That's right. Yes. Yeah.
That was interesting. Yeah, but that was literally dead on, but I think that's because you were also timing it, I'm guessing.
Yeah.
If only Shenmue finished as promptly as Lewis did.
Oh dear. Okay. Well, we've already got some heated thoughts, I think. James, come on. Tell us your thoughts about Shenmue 2.
It's a bit pantomime for me to cuss out Shenmue on a public forum once again. But whilst it's obviously not a game that I personally enjoy, I can totally see you know, everything that Lewis has said around the game. I actually did play this as well as the original. And as I said, it's not for everyone, which is true of a lot of games. I'm sure my choice is going to be similarly disputed by the majority of the fan base. But you can't. One thing I've always said about Shenmue and Shenmue 2 is that you just can't take away the technical achievement that they both had and the cultural significance that it had on the console. And for that reason, I think whether you would like the games or love them, you know, they will always be a significant piece of Dreamcast history.
Very true. Yeah. Another person not so keen on Shenmue, even if they appreciate what they've done in terms of general gameplay innovations and things like that, is Steve. Mm-hmm. Shenmue 2, you played this, right? And you preferred this to 1, if I'm thinking correctly.
I did prefer it to 1, yes. Yeah. It's a low bar, but I preferred it. No, I'm kidding. So, you know, there's a bit of a history on Dreamcast years of me not liking Shenmue, and we all have fun and games and a good jolly old jape about this, but a lot of people really love this game, and there's a good reason for that. And, you know, we are in December, so I'm not here to kick down somebody's heartfelt appreciation. That said, it is an irredeemably turgid crock of shit.
Oh my. I mean, does anybody else want to jump in Shenmue's defense here? No?
I mean,
it's not all bad. It's, yeah, there's a lot to like about it. It's just, it's too slow. The first game saw you driving a forklift truck around to move boxes for hours and hours, and not content with that, the second game makes you do that by hand, which, talk about dialing things up to 11, like, come on. Like, it's the game is just full of just very slow things that just drive me crazy. I was kidding when I called it interminably turgid or whatever I said, but yeah, this game does my nut in.
Can I speak, or am I not allowed?
It's been a hotly contested thing on Dreamcast years, but go on, you can speak, it's fine.
Yeah, just elaborating on, this wasn't in my original pitch, but like elaborating on like how I said it was you know, that last part of Shenmue 2 is like a blueprint for modern story driven games. Like if you just look at a game like Life is Strange or, you know, anything else similar to that, like, you know, Firewatch, like these games that kind of like really focus on like people as their like, you know, core story mechanic, I suppose, I don't know. But that bit at the end of Shenmue 2, like, what other game was doing this thing where the gameplay was literally just walking from point A to point B with the focus being on the two characters' conversation? Like, to me, that just blew my mind. Like, wow, you know, and that was before, you know, like indie games kind of like, you know, made it more mainstream, I suppose. So yeah, that's my thought on it anyway. And that bit I just love at the end of the game, you know, it's more memorable to me than black cars and you know, sailors. So yeah.
I mean, there's a lot to be said for execution though, and I don't necessarily disagree with you, but it's not the most interesting conversation that they're having.
Oh, it so is.
I mean, I'm always torn on this. I mean, we'll get to my pick later, but for Shenmue 2, I mean, it's I don't know. I mean, I think it's interesting. Yeah, it's if we're talking about the structured narrative of any of these games, as far as the authored like storytelling in terms of dialogue, character development, whatever, these are AM2 are not, I'm sorry, but I mean, they are not storytellers. Like, that is not why I come to these games. Specifically, Shenmue 2, I think, has kind of a bombast and a, it's more about just like going through it and the experience of having these high highs, maybe literally with the skyscraper battle, and then you know, the quiet moments in between, and all of the range of different experiences that it lets you kind of poke and prod at as you spend your time in Hong Kong and in the surrounding areas. That and it's more about just that journey rather, or like personally, and I'll get into this with my pick a bit, but more than just like caring about any one character's, you know, journey. Like Ryo, I don't care about Ryo. Like, I just don't. I think he's an idiot. You know, whatever. It's like he'll talk to the same 10 people to get the one clue that he could have deduced just from a single conversation. You know, I don't think that any of us are. There is a charm to it, though. Like, I don't think it's good, but I love that it has this kind of I don't know, B movie hokey, maybe just like 80s kung fu movie style of storytelling that is kind of interesting and at least charming in its own right, even if it's not coherent or competent.
Yeah, that's fair enough. Absolutely. All right. Jason, we have not heard from you. Any thoughts on Shenmue 2?
Well, I'm sitting here on a Dreamcast podcast, and I have to sit here and say that Shenmue 2 came a little bit too late for me in my Dreamcast life, and I never really played it. So it feels a bit blasphemous to say that, and I feel like you're all hanging up on me right now. But obviously, I've got experience of playing the first one, but I think where Shenmue 2 came so late in the Dreamcast life, and I think I kind of slightly moved on by then. Other things started distracting me, so I don't have a lot of experience with this game, and I feel quite bad for not playing this game. And it's something I am planning to write next year, because I do have it sitting on my GDEMU ready to go. So yes, I do apologize, all Sega Dreamcast fans. I feel like I'm getting daggers.
You are. No, yeah, you're not. It's fine. It's cool. I mean, yeah. I think it's worth playing. And also, we are doing, at some point, we're doing another crossover episode with the DreamPod, where we'll be talking about 2002, which in the UK, at least, is when Shenmue 2 came out on the Dreamcast. So maybe worth trying to get at least a little bit of it in before then.
Yeah, definitely. So you can
have a bit of a discussion with us. But yeah, it's certainly worth playing. And the good thing about Shenmue 2 now is that, great if you've got it on your GDEMU, but also it's available basically every platform now, right? It's on Xbox, yeah. PlayStation, PC. Mm-hmm. So you can play it everywhere, which is great.
Yeah, I mean, there's a few series that I want to go back to that I haven't played in a long time, or you know, things like Halo and stuff. I never played all the original Halo games, and playing Infinite now, I really want to go back and play those as well. So in my mind, I feel like the first 3 or 4 months of next year, I just want to play old games and try and ignore new games, which I think is going to be quite a hard challenge. But it's something I want to do, because it's saying I want to go and play these games to, you know, and have the experience of playing them. And Shenmue 2, and even going back and playing Shenmue 1 again is something that's high on my list of things to do, even though I think that's going to take me about 3 months anyway.
Well, hopefully you'll be able to let us know how you get on with that on either a Dreamcast Years episode or maybe a Dream Pod at some point.
Sure.
We'll find out. So, Lewis, let us know a track from Shenmue 2 that you want to highlight.
Yeah, so I just want to highlight the song from the part of the game that I like waxed so lyrically about, and that's the theme that plays in Guilin Forest.
Let's have a listen. Awesome. Well, there we go. That's Shenmue 2. Let's move on to the next pitch. And so let's move on to a Dreamcast Years host. Now, I think, Jason, we were just speaking to you. So let's jump into your pitch. Is that okay?
Okay.
All right. All right. So what are you going to be pitching us for your favourite Dreamcast game?
Well, on a previous Dreamcast Years podcast, I did claim that Crazy Taxi was my favourite Dreamcast game. And I still sit here and claim that is true, but I feel like, you know, we've talked about that game numerous times. We all know the game. So I wanted to choose another one of my favorite games that I always look back on fondly and always rejoy and also enjoy replaying, and that game is Metropolis Street Racer.
Awesome. Rejoy should be a word. I like that. Re-enjoying it. That's cool. Okay, so I'm gonna count you down, and you've got 1 minute to pitch as to why Metropolis Street Racer is the best Dreamcast game. Are you ready?
I'm going off the cuff this time. Last time I was prepared, this time it's just gonna be a shambles. I just pre-warn you now. But yes, let's go. This might last only 20 seconds. I just, you know. But...
At least we're not asking you to do it in the voice of a pirate. So
yeah,
it's more mercy. All right, your time starts now.
So Metropolis Street Racer is a racing game, but it sets you in real life cities and places, which really helps to put you into the game, especially like if you live in any of these kind of cities or you've ever visited them. You know, I always used to love going around London because it was I could recognize places and things like that. And back then it wasn't really that well done, was it? To put these real life places into a racing game. Excuse me. And also with the QDOS system and all this, you know, trying to encourage you to drift and score all these different points. And it was a completely new system and a game changer, really, in racing games. And then, of course, you've got the music as well. You know, I think this was just before Grand Theft Auto 3, and you had all the radio stations with all this different music, and you had like proper music songs as well, which really was new to me.
Not letting you carry on this time, Jason. Once was enough. You can't get away with it again. But thank you very much for your pitch from Metropolis Street Racer. Somebody who very much likes racing games, especially on the Dreamcast, is James.
Yeah, I think Jason summed it up nicely to say, you know, it was a game changer. And I think it's completely fair to call Metropolis Street Racer a game changer. And it's criminal, really, that it didn't sell as much as that it was marketed and was supposed to do so. I think, you know, you look back to the late 90s, early 2000s, and it was really the coming of age of the racing genre, really. You know, you look back at PlayStation all the way through, and it was that was the genre. If the 360 and the PS3 was all about first person shooters, I think racing games and the advancements that happened were certainly the generation before. And MSR, I mean, obviously the DNA lived on through Project Gotham Racing, then on the Xbox, and then PGR2, which is one of the best Xbox Live games for quite a while. And I think I thought it was an amazing game. It was I found it super polished. I know there were quite a number of sort of high profile bugs and issues that were raised about the game, including a game breaking one that I don't know if it was just PAL regions that had that, but something that they had to do a massive recall on at the beginning. But it looks great. Tons of licensed cars modeled, you know, to a new level of detail that we hadn't seen before on console games up to this point. You know, you look at something like Gran Turismo, which was, you know, amazing back in the day. And I think looking at PGR puts it to shame, really. And yeah, I think if I was only going to criticize it in any way, it would just be on the track variety, really. I think, you know, as we said, they took a long time in boasting about it being across these three or four or five, you know, major cities, which was great. But I think in doing that and spending all the time mapping out these cities to make it look as realistic as possible, I think the actual track layouts, you know, suffered a little bit because of that. And I think I would have liked to have seen a little bit more exciting layouts and things. But yeah, really, really great game. And obviously it was kind of the icing on the cake back in the day was the online leaderboards and stuff, where you could see how you shaped up to drivers across the across Europe or in your region, which was something that I did back in the day as well. So yeah, this is certainly up there as one of the best racing games on Dreamcast, and for my two cents, it's probably in the top 10 of games that I would pick.
Excellent. Anybody else got any particularly strong feelings on Metropolis Street Racer? Either way, if you don't like it, let us all know.
I loved it, but I don't really have a ton to add. I mean, I think you all hit on it pretty well.
Fair enough.
And I do, and you know, James, you alluded like how its DNA kind of lived on. I mean, it does with the Project Gotham series. It does kind of suck that arcade racers of that cloth seem to be a little more rare than they used to be, but I am always encouraged when something like, you know, the stuff that Playground Games works on with the Forza Horizon series, especially Horizon 5. I've had a lot of fun with that game, and I think that tapped into a lot of the appeal that games like Metropolis Street Racer really, you know, solidified back in the day for me.
Yeah, it was definitely, certainly in Europe anyway, I'm not sure if anyone else agrees, but from my memory of being around when Dreamcast was contemporary, it was one of the most sort of hyped and advertised games for the console coming out. And I've just been checking now, I think it was, the game only sold 120,000 copies worldwide, with about 13,000 in Europe, which is just, you know, it's just bonkers compared to you know, compared to what you see nowadays for a major first party published game that was like your flagship racing game to only sell 13,000 copies in Europe is just, and I, yeah, it's just staggering, really. And it deserves so much more. It was you know, it wasn't a bad game by any stretch. It deserved to be one of the best selling Dreamcast games. And I know Dreamcast games in general didn't sell amazingly well when you compare it to other consoles, but still 13,000 in Europe is just, yeah, it's just shocking.
Presumably that explains why this game was so easy to get sealed. I presume, can you still get it sealed for like cheap now, or
not so much anymore? As not, because I bought a sealed copy, funny enough, about must be about five or so years ago now, and I think I paid about a tenner for it sealed. But yeah, you can still pick it up for about 30-40 quid sealed nowadays. But yeah, it's that's probably one of the reasons there were box loads of them left over.
Yes. I think Pixel Heart has them in there, €25, so brand new sealed, which is pretty awesome.
Yeah,
definitely. That will. I was going to say the same thing, Lewis. It definitely goes some way to explain why there's such an abundance of sealed copies of that game. But it seems daft, because it is such an incredible game, and it's from a company who, you know, thank goodness that they went on to create Project Gotham Racing and then had success with that. And you know, it's a shame that then things like Blur didn't have the same kind of success, and that, you know, Bizarre Creations ended up folding, because, you know, their racing games were incredible, and even Blur coming towards the end of their lifespan was an incredible racing game with that arcade sensibility again. And like you say, Metropolis Street Racer kind of started all of that off for a lot of these kind of modern games that take into account you know, kind of scores based on style and things like that, which, as Brian pointed out, things like Forza do as well. And in fact, quite a lot of racing games now do that. The Need for Speed games kind of rate you on style and things like that, right? So it's very much ahead of its time for a first of its kind. So to only have sold 13,000 copies in Europe is absolutely crazy.
It also makes no sense, because if it came out in like 2002 or something, you could understand it. But I mean, it was originally supposed to be a launch title for Dreamcast in Europe, I believe. Got pushed back, I think, to late 2000. But ultimately, it's not like we're talking about it being at a time where everyone had moved on and started buying PS2s. You know, it was still very much during the contemporary lifespan of Dreamcast. So yeah, it just doesn't add up to me.
Definitely doesn't. Before we move on, need to get a music track from you, Jason, from Metropolis Street Racer. So let us know the track that you've chosen that you really love from this game.
Yes, of course. My track that I chose was called Let's Get It On Tonight. And it sounds really mucky, doesn't it? But I chose it. It's one of the pieces of music from the game that's like a proper song. I just loved hearing this song. It was just one of those songs when it came on, I was like, yes. And especially when you're cruising around in a car and it's during the day and the sun's out and such. And it just gave me that kind of sunny summertime kind of vibe. And I always just used to put a smile on my face.
Nice. Let's hear it.
Ha! What? Ha! Ha! Come on! Woo! Just cruising. Excuse me, sorry, but I didn't mean to trouble you. I was just cruising along in my BMW when I saw you driving by. You caught my eye, and then I thought, why are you on your own, all alone? Talking with someone on the end of a phone. Is there another guy just waiting for you to get home? Ha! Girl, I should have known. So what's the deal between you and me? Can we get together, watch TV? I know there's a place that you'd rather be, where the money means nothing and the drinks are free. Let me take you there, no need to be aware. Did I tell you I'm a millionaire? Forget about him, I'll treat you right. Let me turn out the light and we can get it on tonight. Ha!
All night.
Come on! Yeah! Let's get it on tonight.
Okay, so let's move on and go back to a DreamPod host. Brian, let's come to you next. Are you ready to pitch?
I mean, no, but let's do it anyway.
Let's do it anyway. All right, and can you tell us, what game are you pitching?
Today I will be pitching Shenmue. The original Shenmue, because why not? Somebody had to, so might as well be me.
Fair enough. All right. I've got the timer here. So, Brian, your time to pitch Shenmue starts now.
Yeah, so Shenmue did a lot. I mean, it expanded my understanding of the kinds of experiences that medium is capable of. And I do appreciate the unique and interesting ways that, you know, we can interact and connect with video games beyond just like their fun factor or traditional benchmarks of gameness. I mean, it really tapped into something very different. And instead, Shenmue presents more of a cozy and dense virtual home away from home, so to speak, that invites me to inhabit it rather than conquer it. And for me, the heart of Shenmue's appeal is in the narratives that unfold more or less organically, just shaped by how I spend my time in the space, whether it's pestering folks who are on their daily routines around town, knocking on every door and picking up every object for no reason other than because I can, or just simply immersing myself in its community Main Street atmosphere. There's just a magic in the mundanity. An aimlessness of it, I was just going to say, that kind of just draws me in as I revisit it today.
Taking liberties there, going over the time, but I'll allow it. It's fine. It's Christmas.
Okay. Can we complete the sentence so that we're in the middle? Does that help? Is that like
not really allowed? I usually.
Andrew is relentless about this kind of thing.
Well, thank you for being so generous today, Andrew.
It's Winterfest. You gotta give some cut some slack for Winterfest. Jason, you said you didn't play Shenmue 2. Have you played the first Shenmue?
Yes, I have played Shenmue. I've not played it to completion. But yes, I have had some form of experience with the game. And I think I've said on previous pods that it was an amazing game at the time, just for the things that we know about Shenmue, you know, with the day-night cycle and the story itself. And I quite liked how slow it was. Nice to be able to enjoy the story that it was trying to tell you.
Yep. That's why I went for drink just as you said that.
Of course.
So you ended your sentence.
That was what would happen.
Lewis, obviously you pitched Shenmue 2. So what are your thoughts on the original game? And what is it that made you choose the second one over the first?
Yeah, it's a thing that I kind of like talk about a lot to people, but feel like my my sort of love for Shenmue 2 is mostly going into the void because no one seems to agree with me. It's the same with Power Stone 2. No one seems to agree with me on that either. But no, I love Shenmue 2 because I over Shenmue 1. Like, I love Shenmue 1. Like, when I first played it, like, I mean, I spoke a lot about this on the was it the 2000? Crossover one we did, I think.
Yeah,
was it 2000? Yeah, 2000. So I've got kind of a better pitch of Shenmue there, but yeah, I just, you know, I love sort of escapism in games, and you know, as I think Steve said, it's like going on a little holiday, as he put it on that episode, and that is kind of what it's like. But it's like you feel kind of like you know, out of so many games I've played, this is the one where you truly feel like I personally truly feel like I'm like stepping into the shoes of somebody else. And it's like this great game in that regard. Like, and you just feel like I suppose it's the detail of like the environments that really kind of like pull you in as well. Like, you know, you could play a visual novel and, you know, immerse yourself through clicking various options, but you know, when you're walking around those neighborhoods, it just feels like so much more, you know, deep, I suppose. But I like Shenmue 2 just because of the expanse of like the areas. And also it's just like really cool that there's a game where you can just roam around Hong Kong. You know, I remember I've got a friend who's from Hong Kong, and I remember he was telling me, he was like, I'm missing home. He was telling me because he was an exchange student studying in England, and he was like, I'm missing home, I want to, you know, I've not been back for so long. And I was like, well, come around my house and I'll show you Shenmue 2. And he was like, yeah, this is like my home. Like, he was like really like, he like appreciated it. So, you know, and just like yeah, it's just a cool game. But yeah, Shenmue 1 is you know, obvious. I obviously understand why people love it, but yeah, I'm just rambling now. Anyway, move off me.
But I think you was mentioned about Hong Kong and stuff in Shenmue 1, for me, it was like seeing this Japanese culture as well, because it was something that I never was really that aware of. Obviously, the internet still coming into its own. So you didn't really, it was a lot harder to really understand what it would be like to be living or visiting Japan unless you actually went there yourself. So to have this game as well, where you could explore these streets that were set in Japan, and it being so, you know, cultural, it was fascinating.
Yeah,
it was kind of a work of virtual tourism in a way.
Sure, yeah, because it made me want to go. Still want to go.
Yeah, almost literally. I mean, you see how you know, Yokosuka, I mean, how they've like embraced that, even with tying it to actual tours and things you can do when you go there and see the streets that inspired Dobita and the harbor and the other locales. Like, I don't know, there's something kind of cool about that, I'd say.
Absolutely. Very true. Very true. All right. So before we move on to the next pitch, Brian, what track from the original Shenmue did you want to highlight here?
Yeah, I couldn't remember the name of it, but I'm looking it up, and I think this is the right one. I'll have to correct myself if I mixed it up. But Harbor Beats, I think, is the track that the beats will be laying down today.
Awesome. Let's have a listen to that. So back to Dreamcast years, and Steve, you ready to pitch?
I am, yes. I also wrote something down about an hour ago, so I'm good to go.
Excellent, excellent.
I'm good to stumble through this.
Yeah, and your forfeit will be, no, I'm just kidding. Don't worry. We're forfeit free this time. Oof. For anybody who hasn't listened to a Dreamcast years episode before, usually when we do this style of podcast, one person will have a forfeit. Usually it's Rich. And it's very often hilarious, but this time, because I'm being nice, because it's, you know, because it's winter time, the most wonderful time of the year, I'm being very nice to everybody. I think I'm being lovely. Steve,
yes,
what game are you pitching for us today?
I am pitching Headhunter.
Okie dokie. All right, I'm gonna count you in. You ready?
Yes.
Okie dokie. Your time starts now.
So Headhunter is a third-person action-adventure game where you spend most of your time on foot shooting bad guys or stealthing and snapping their necks with one hand. It has light cover mechanics, which feel really cool and cinematic and make the shootouts feel satisfying. You get to ride your motorcycle between missions, and while the driving mechanics are pretty rudimentary, they link the missions together in a way that, along with the really fantastic soundtrack, gives the overall world of Headhunter some sense of cohesion and grounding in reality that felt really unique at the time. In fact, where Headhunter stands out is it's in its presentation and story. It's set in what feels like future Los Angeles as imagined in the 1980s, and the whole style feels like a Paul Verhoeven movie, with videos of actors playing news anchors reading the kinds of satirical headlines you'd see in RoboCop, like private companies enforcing the law and criminals having their organs transplanted to benefit the wealthiest in society. The player character is a bounty hunter with amnesia called Jack Wade, and he's exactly the archetype you'd expect him to be from that description. It's ham-fisted as hell, but the game has a lot of heart, and I can't help but being very endeared by it.
You managed to get through that. Did you have anything left after that? Was that the end of it?
That was it.
Wow. It's pretty good. Pretty good. Very, very well presented. So thanks. Well done.
Mm.
Well done. Anybody got any particularly anything particular to say about Headhunter? Anybody want to jump in?
I still need to play it.
You haven't played it yet.
I'll play, like, I'll get into the first mission and then I just, yeah, I need to really just sit down and give it a chance, because I've heard so many great things about it and it just seems like it would be right up my alley. But no, still haven't played it.
Yeah.
Brian, did you like hear about this game at the time? It wasn't released in America, was it?
Oh yeah. Well, no, but I mean, it was in every video game magazine. Mm. Like EGM would have had at least a blurb or two about it, and same with the official Dreamcast magazine here. So definitely knew about it at the time. I mean, it came out a bit later, right? So, I think they had made that decision probably just driven by fiscal factors to not put that money into distributing it over here at that point.
I'm in the same boat. It's definitely one on my backlog to play. I actually received a copy last year or this year. I forget where the time's gone. When I bought my second Dreamcast console to mod, because I didn't want to mod my original launch console, and it had a copy with that, and it was one that I'd never played before. And I've played it for like a couple of minutes, and I was instantly impressed by how good it looked and how smooth everything was and how nice it controlled, because I was kind of dreading that with only one analog stick. But it felt pretty good, and it's certainly one of the ones on my backlog to play through at some point. It's definitely sort of given me the appeal to go back to anyway.
Yeah, it is a bit of a, it's kind of, it was a weird hidden gem for the Dreamcast. Like I say, it only came out in Europe, and it right at the end, it was at the end of 2001, so it was well after the Dreamcast had been discontinued. I mean, Jason, is this one you've played, or is this like Shenmue 2 and came a bit too late for you?
I've recently played some of Headhunter because I got it on the GDMU. So it was one that was missed back in the day. And but yeah, a few months ago, I did fire it up. And I kind of agree with everything that Steve said in his pitch. Just everything about it, I just really loved it, from the looks to the character and everything, and the exploring around the area that you start the game in. But then when you get out and you get on that motorbike, it just, I don't know, it just opens up the game, and just having that two different kind of gameplay things mixing together is just back then it must have been quite a revelation. But to me, it was just a great mix.
Nice.
Yeah, it's cool. It's like you're done shooting a bunch of guys here in this diner, and then some story happens and they say, now you have to shoot a whole different bunch of guys, but they're over town across that way. And instead of just, you know, the game teleporting you across town, you get on your bike with, you know, a sense of purpose and you ride across town. It doesn't seem like that's a big deal these days, but at the time that felt really cool.
It was. And the town and the buildings and all, it was quite well realized as well, really.
It was,
wasn't it?
Yes. Yeah. It's not well known for being a particularly handsome game, but I actually think it looks really nice. I think it really nails the look that they're going for.
I think when I played it and I looked at it and I thought, well, for a 2001 Dreamcast game, this is pretty awesome.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. When you get to nighttime scenes and when there's rain and things like that, it looks really atmospheric. It's pretty awesome.
Just a quick question. Is it fairly linear then? I mean, when you're like driving across town, are those like dedicated linear segments, or is it more open?
So it is an open map, but and part of the progression of the game as well is earning points on your motorcycle by driving in a particular way, like driving cleanly and driving fast. And you can achieve those points by sort of riding around in the open world. But calling it an open world is generous. There isn't really anything in it other than other cars, and then that's it. So it's linear in a sense, but you can technically go wherever you want to.
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
The areas that you then go to, and it usually gives you just the one story location you can go to, right? And then when you get there, that's a linear progression, and then you go back on your motorbike and go to the next story location. So, yeah. But it's interesting. Lewis, is this one that have you played Headhunter?
I have it, but I have never sunk that much time into it. It's just never got around to it. Yep.
Well, that's three people from the Dreamcast Junkyard who need to play Headhunter. It's putting you on the list here. I don't know what this list is for, but it's a list nonetheless.
Santa's naughty list.
Yeah. Very true. Steve, what song from Headhunter did you want everybody to have a listen to?
So the soundtrack is fantastic. It's by a guy called Richard Jakes. Is that how you say his second name? Jakes?
I think so. Mm. Jax. Jax. I've never heard.
It is brilliant. And the theme that I would like you to listen to is called Jax Theme, and it is the theme that plays when you're on the motorcycle, and it's very sweeping and orchestral, and it's very Hollywood, and it'll give you a good flavour of the kind of tone the game's going for.
It's also 5 minutes long, so you know, go make yourself a cup of tea while it plays.
I'm only going to play a clip of it. Have a listen. Well, who does that leave us with then? From the Dreamcast Junkyard side, that leaves us with the lovely James. I already know what you're going to pitch, and I almost don't want to come to you.
Rude. After calling me lovely, and then you come up, you then you follow it with that.
The shit sandwich technique, isn't it? All right, James. Let's just get this over with. What is it that you're pitching us?
I feel like I'm losing battle here already. So the game I'm going to be pitching today is Spirit of Speed 1937. And before I start, I do want to caveat this by saying that obviously, I know the assignment was pitch your favorite game. Obviously, Spirit of Speed is not my all-time favorite Dreamcast game. However, it is a game that I feel like I need to champion with every public forum that I am afforded. And it is a game that I do genuinely enjoy playing. So hence my decision to go with that season.
Right. Okay. Well, are you ready? Are you ready to pitch?
I'm ready to pitch. I'm always ready to pitch Spirit of Speed, mate. You know me.
Do you? Yeah, okay.
We didn't have to do any prep for tonight, boys.
Yeah, this is why we picked two Shenmue games to sort of help our side on the poll. Yeah, sort of like balance this out.
When you were saying about the poll at the beginning, I was thinking, oh man, I'm really going to let the junkyard down at this point.
Yeah.
Oh dear. Okay, let's get started on this. James, your minute starts now.
So I'll start off by saying that Spirit of Speed 1937 is one of the most criminally misunderstood games on the Dreamcast, because the truth is most casual racers boot it up and expect to wall ride their way to victory in every race they take part in. The truth nobody wants to hear about Spirit of Speed 1937 is that 90% of people who claim to hate it have played it for no more than 30 seconds at best, and most have never even played it at all. There's loads of cars, and for a motor racing anorak, you know, a lot of accuracy in there, loads of tracks, loads of variety, loads of different game modes. It's a genuinely difficult game. It's not a let's just make the AI impossibly fast way difficult artificially. You've got to drive these cars, you've got to practice, and you've got to think ahead. It's unforgiving. It doesn't hold your hand. It's hard work, but that's what driving a Formula One car in 1937 was all about. Spirit of Speed 1937 is the Dark Souls of racing games, and you only hate it because you can't handle it.
Wow.
Good Lord. So are you basically saying get good?
Get good.
Right.
Well, you made me want to play it.
I'm going to drop my steering wheel and walk out.
Lay down the gauntlet for everybody there.
I still can't tell if he's joking or not.
He's not. I can tell you for certain he's not. Oh, my goodness.
I wrote 10 pages about this game for Andrew's book.
I can put my hand up and say I've never once played this game. I know its reputation, but I've just not played it. I do have it on my GDMU now, which at the moment is broken, so I can't play it. Does anybody else have any experience with Spirit of Speed?
Can I dive in?
Go on.
So, I feel like I used to chat shit about this game, but then James swayed me. Don't get me wrong, I can't play it at all. Like, I'll suck at it, and I don't think I have the time for it. However, I just, yeah, I can't help but like it slightly because of James's, like, you know, very passionate plea to us. You know, his stream he did where he, like, explained sort of the ins and outs of it was incredibly fascinating. So I would like to say that there's a term in Japan called kusoge, which literally means shitty game. But it's like a thing in Japan, like a culture of people who embrace games that are kind of crap, but they're fun too. Like, I think the biggest example is it Death Crimson? That's like the famous kusoge game. And I think this is like the Dreamcast's like big kusoge game. Although, you know, using a Japanese term doesn't help because this sold 87 copies in Japan. you know, but yeah, I am completely backing James on this one because, you know, brothers, man, you know, Dreamcast Junkyard Brothers.
I feel terrible for ripping on Shenmue. I feel like I'm going to have to go and play it after this.
Oh, dear. Has anybody else played Spirit of Speed?
I kind of want to now.
Yeah, that pitch has had that effect.
Mm.
I mean, I played 20 minutes of Spirit Seed. So I've lasted the 30 seconds or, you know, more than what James said in the pitch.
You're in the 10%.
Yeah. And yeah. That's the only 20 minutes I've ever played.
I will say that the authority, Tom Charnock, hates this game. So and Mike. So, you know, it isn't obviously like, and I feel like they definitely would have played it for more than 30 seconds. But, you know, this is another one of them games where, like, Angry Video Game Nerd covers it and then everyone who's, like, new to retro gaming just kind of shits on it, like the Jaguar controller. But
do you know what? That's the funny thing. AVGN, even they couldn't do an episode on it because it ended up being in one of their, like, Mike and James Mondays or whatever it was called, because even they couldn't find stuff that was actually that bad about it to actually put in an episode. They just thought it was a bit boring, which is what people get. But it's like, well, yeah, if you don't like old racing cars and old racing tracks, don't play a game focused around old racing cars and old tracks because you're going to find it boring.
Yeah. Fair. Yeah.
I think there is going to be an AVGM because he's doing that, like,
yeah, that, it'll be he will touch on it now, I think. Yeah,
because he's doing the LJN, like all the ones he hasn't reviewed, and the second part is coming soon, presumably, and he hasn't spoke about Spirit of Speed yet, so I think it will be in there.
Can I just add one more thing, Andrew, on this? Am I allowed to? Just because I've done obviously a load of research on this game in all seriousness, because I do enjoy it. And as you know, I wanted to try and give some good insight into the game for the book. And I read a lot of reviews, both contemporary from the time and also people doing retrospectives. I watched a lot of videos. And I think what really annoyed me is just the same excuses keep coming back up. And it's become satire now to say the game's bad because the control is awful. And, you know, if you actually understand how to drive the cars, if you actually get the fact that, you know, brakes in the 1930s were not like brakes on modern Formula One cars, and you have to brake a lot sooner before the corner, then, yeah, it does handle very differently. And the other one I read was how, you know, some of the cars are so much faster than the others. And again, it's like, well, you read the instruction manual, if nothing else, and it will tell you that's because they need to do a lot more pit stops than you. The one negative thing I will say about the game is it doesn't, although it doesn't hold your hand, it doesn't do itself any favors with things like, I actually started off a new championship earlier on today because I wanted to get it a bit fresh in my mind before we did this. The first two races in the championship took me over half an hour each to finish. And, you know, that's not really, if you're not expecting it, that's not really ideal. But yeah, apart from that, I think I encourage you all to go into it with an open mind and try it.
Fair enough. I think there's quite a few people who will.
Your pitch has made me look at the game in a different light.
Yeah, you had me at Dark Souls of racing games.
I might put that quote on my Twitter bio or something like that now.
Yeah, I'm in a similar boat as Jason on this. I feel like I've put in maybe an hour or two. I feel like it's just not, I don't have any ill will against Spirit of Speed. I just don't know if it hits in the way that I look for in most racing games that I enjoy. I did actually kind of find it fairly rewarding though when I could get through a race without, like, you know, crashing or getting, you know, hitting one of the houses in the village or just, you know, scraping the wall and letting everybody pass me. It was a similar feeling as Monaco Grand Prix in a way, where it took me a little bit, but as soon as there was like a rewarding sense in itself just to be able to finish a race competently. And so, yeah, I don't know. I get it. I don't think it's a terrible game. It's just not one that really struck a chord with me necessarily.
James.
Yes.
Can I ask you if there was going to be the crown on if we were going to crown the worst game on Dreamcast, would we go for something more like Taxi 2 over this?
Yeah, but I think Taxi 2 also comes in the so bad it's actually enjoyable camp. Again, I sort of played through that recently because of the translation, and I think, yeah, that was another a game that was just so bad that I'd say Taxi 2 was a genuinely bad game. I think Spirit of Speed is it's a bad game if you don't want a realistic racing game from the 1930s. If you do, then I don't think it's a bad game. That's my final defense, Your Honor.
I will say I'm looking at a video on YouTube and it looks real bad.
See, the different tracks I think look bad on it. There's one track in particular where the frame rate really struggles, just because of the design of the track. I think more than anything, it was programmed in using Windows CE, which wasn't a great choice. But yeah, I think it looks fine on some of the levels. But a pro tip for anyone who does play it is press up on the D-pad when you start, because it shows you all of your fuel and oil levels and tire wear and stuff, which is pretty critical actually to being able to finish races. Otherwise you're gonna find that you get 5 laps into a 20 lap race and just die in the middle of the track.
And if you crash, you have to drive back to where you crashed to collect your souls, is that right?
Yes, you need to find a bonfire in the
fine
crash.
Got it. Okay. Yeah. Okay.
I think the trouble with Spirit Seed as well is that it's just got a lot of competition on the Dreamcast with other racing games. And I appreciate you saying about it's trying to give you that authentic 1930s driving feel, but with the other complaints of the game, I think that may be probably why a lot of people just think it's shit and move along to something else, another racing game on the Dreamcast that fits their needs much better.
Yeah, absolutely. You're not wrong. And I think, yeah, how they marketed it, and again, actually, without spending too long on this, when I spoke to the guys who made the game as part of the research for the book, you know, one of the things they said was that if they could do it all over again, you know, how they marketed it would be a very different thing. And ultimately, they went through a number of different recycles of the code where it was kind of, do we make it realistic or do we make it arcade? And it was trying to find that weird balance in between. And as you said, ultimately, if someone just wants to pick up and play a racing game, they're going to go and get Speed Devils or, you know, Sega Rally or something like that instead. It's quite a unique audience that you're looking at for something like this.
The small audience, right? They've kind of hemmed themselves into a niche, really, haven't they? And it's like, well, how many people are actually going to want that who also own a Dreamcast? And the answer was very few.
I mean, so. Sorry, Andrew, I know I'm going on with this. I could literally talk about this all night. you look at the, I mean, the game was obviously PC originally, published by Microprose on PC, who were, you know, massively big for publishing racing sims back in the day. And you all you've got to do is go and look at the reception that the game had on PC compared to the reception the game had on Dreamcast. And it was like a completely different game. You know, it was very, very well, I wouldn't say very well received, but it was certainly, you know, it was a 6-7 out of 10 game on PC, whereas it's, you know, universally mocked on Dreamcast as, well, one of the worst games on the console, which, as I said, I think is grossly unfair.
That's fair enough. All right, well, let's end our talk on Spirit of Speed and let's have a quick listen to one of your favorite tracks from the game, James. Which track are you choosing?
Another reason why you got to love the game. You can hear the main menu theme music, and if you don't sit around bobbing your head or doing a little dance on your chair, then I'll be amazed.
All right. Let us know if that's what you do. Let's have a listen. Okay, last pitch. Now, this should have been Rich, and Rich chose Giant Gram something or other. It was a wrestling game. Does anybody know the name of the game?
I never know the game that Rich is going to pitch.
It's a difficult one. It's a Japanese wrestling game. Sounded incredibly left field, and I'm sure that that and Spirit of Speed would probably have come very low down the rankings if we were to put it out to a public vote. To be honest, after James's impassioned pitch, I wouldn't be surprised if Spirit of Speed came higher than I thought it was going to come. But yeah, Rich isn't here, so I'm pitching instead, and there's no way I can pitch that game because I've never played it, and it's just not something I can pitch. So I'm going to pitch something different. Does somebody have a timer for me?
I have a timer ready for you.
Excellent. Can always rely on Steve for a timer. All right, so I'm going to pitch... I mean, there's so many Dreamcast games, like so many. I could pitch Jet Set Radio, I could pitch Skies of Arcadia, D2, Space Channel 5, all sorts of games. There's Power Stone. There's so many games that I love on the Dreamcast. But I'm going to pitch the game that made me buy a Dreamcast, which was Resident Evil Code Veronica.
Shock horror to anyone that knows you at all in any... Uh-huh.
Yeah. All right,
are you ready?
As I'll ever be.
I'll count you down. 3, 2, 1, go.
So Resident Evil Code Veronica is the first proper true 3D Resident Evil game. It's a huge get for the Dreamcast. It was, you know, the one that started the trend of survival horror games moving toward 3D, of course, along with Dino Crisis. And it was just absolutely incredible. It was marketed as this amazing looking 3D title that was full of horror and advanced the story of Resident Evil beyond what we'd seen before. Brought back Claire from Resident Evil 2 and Chris, which is her brother, from Resident Evil 1. And they go to a base somewhere on an island to find that there's more zombies and more Umbrella. It's just an incredible survival horror game, probably the best on the Dreamcast, definitely the best on the Dreamcast, and one of the better Resident Evil games, especially from the old school style. I'm struggling now. It's just brilliant, has a wild and wacky story, but does everything Time. So well. There we go.
Good job.
I mean, it wasn't really, but thanks.
considering you didn't know you were going to do that until, you know, 5 minutes before we started.
True. That's true. Thanks. I'll take that. I'll take that win for today. Who wants to jump in and talk a bit about Resident Evil Code Veronica?
I can now because I've played it.
Ooh.
I'd played it before, but like it was mainly me and my cousin were sort of like tag teaming it, and I kind of just let him play most of it. But I've actually played it properly and engaged with it, and I like it. It's definitely like a spectacle on the Dreamcast, and definitely cool that it was, like, you know, as you say, Andrew, the first fully 3D game. So it definitely feels like that jump to the next generation. The only thing I'd say about it is I don't really care for the setting. I've played kind of like quite a good way in. I still need to get, you know, to the next. I know there's like two bits in it. I still need to get to the second part, but like I wasn't really bothered about the island where Claire is. I think it's just because I've played the first and the second, and I just like, I love the mansion and the police precinct like a lot more in that regard. And yeah, I mean, and also there's the character in it who's just like really annoying, and I can't remember his name.
Steve,
yeah. He's a sort, yeah. Just the bit where he like, you need a gun for something to like open something, and he like takes it and you're just like, oh my god, like I hate you so much. So yeah, it's a cool game, and like I can totally understand what I've heard on the Dreamcast Years pod before, where, you know, like that bit where you walk into that barracks and there's like the light like swinging on the ceiling and like the shadows, and it is a really good looking game, and annoyingly not playable through PAL VGA on the PAL version, which like winds me up. But yeah, so yeah, that is yeah, it's a cool game, and I can understand why it's one of your favorites, Andrew.
Yeah, I can add to that. And he's as a fellow Resident Evil fanboy, you know, was massively into Resident Evil on the PlayStation. It wasn't the reason I got a Dreamcast, but it was one of the first games on Dreamcast that I remember pre-ordering from Gameplay of all places, the telephone as it was at the time, order place. And I think I've said this before on some podcast. The most impressive thing I think you can say about Code Veronica is that it really made the jump from what was, you know, a sort of pseudo 3D environments to fully 3D, you know, backgrounds and everything, compared to the pre-rendered stuff that you had on PlayStation. It made that jump so effortlessly that you almost forgot what Resident Evil games used to be like, with the static cameras and the way that the backgrounds used to be. And I think that's quite a testament, because, you know, the Resident Evil always punched above its weight on PlayStation because of the pre-rendered backgrounds. It looked really, really good, especially on a CRT. And so being able to get that much detail into the new fully 3D backgrounds in a game that was the kind of the first to do it, I think is something to be commended. And the other part of it is, being a Dreamcast fanboy, it was having an exclusive Resident Evil game on the console was one that I... just a fact that I really loved back in the day as well. But I think I mentioned earlier MSI in my top 10. I think Code Veronica would certainly be in my top 10 as well.
Nice. Anybody else got fond memories or otherwise of Code Veronica?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I do. I think you and I in particular had a good time playing through this game together. It's easy to like this game because it's still sort of feels like the underdog in a way, because it only came out on the Dreamcast, so it feels like the one. I mean, you know, obviously it's been ported everywhere else since, but at the time it was an exclusive, and it was a bit of a showcase on the Dreamcast for all of the reasons that have already been described here. And yeah, I will say I keep wanting to go back to this game. I really want to play through this game again, but I the only thing about it, I don't think it's aged particularly well in some ways. And the thing that annoys me the most is the amount of time you spend in that menu going into your inventory over and over again and coming back out again. I feel like you do it more in Code Veronica than you do in any other Resident Evil game. Not quite sure why.
You could call it the Dark Souls of menu management.
You could, that's right. Yep. And if you press the wrong menu thing, you have to go back to where you press the wrong menu thing. Anyway. So the story in Code Veronica was bonkers. Obviously, every other story in Resident Evil is pretty bonkers. But is Code Veronica, like, does this mark the first time that it went proper bonkers? Because it is off its nut, the story in this game, right?
I feel like it does, like, it kind of relies heavily on really super eccentric characters, right?
That's right, yes.
And beforehand you had Wesker maybe, and you know, you'd occasionally get some weird lines of dialogue, but everybody was fairly normal apart from some of the, you know, apart from Wesker maybe, whereas this one had, like, you know, a proper unhinged antagonist.
So, it really did.
And Steve. So,
and it took itself really seriously, even though you've got this chap. He's like a military guy, right? Like a military commander, but he's got like a split personality, and you think it's two separate characters, but they're actually the same character. It's bizarre. It's, and I feel like this is sort of maybe the first time Resident Evil strayed that far into bonkersville. But anyway.
Yeah, this is like something that makes me sound like a real noob, but like going back to it after playing the GameCube Resident Evil remake, the tank controls feel a little bit kind of, I don't know, like slightly too late. If you look at something like D2, like the control on that, even on one analog stick, is just like really nice. And obviously that came out before Code Veronica. So that's like one gripe I have. Like, obviously I can deal with it, but it's like, if you compare it to like Resident Evil remake, like the way they managed the controls in that, even though they're still kind of tanky, like just feel a lot smoother. So that's like the only thing about this game that just like, I'm not so keen on.
Didn't this game have your pulse meet your health pulse thing on the VMU, or am I making that up?
It did.
That was really cool.
Yeah, that was a good feature. Sure.
Yeah. Which of course means you don't have to go into your inventory to check your health, which means you're in the inventory less.
Just null and void everything you said. So
I've probably played this game more so on other platforms that don't have the VMU, which might explain why I feel like I'm in the menu so often.
Yeah, perhaps. Yeah, that's possibly true.
I think one of the biggest things I learned about this game recently was that isn't Code Veronica kind of the true third game in the series?
Pretty much, yeah. It was I think it was meant to be, and then there was it's all in Alex O'Neill's book, The Itchy Tasty, the unofficial history of Resident Evil. But yeah, essentially I think it's something along the lines of PlayStation wanted a third game, and so they made what was meant to be a side story into Resident Evil 3 and Code Veronica essentially into a side story, but it continues the stories of 1 and 2.
Yeah, it happens straight after 2, doesn't it? Or quite soon after 2, as far as the plot's concerned on it.
Yeah, exactly. It's not too far afterwards, so.
But yeah, it was a great, like you say, great get for the Dreamcast and Capcom having the faith in, unfortunately having the faith to put it on the Dreamcast. But that was kind of Capcom at the time, though, really, wasn't it? Like, thank you. Sorry, edit that bit out. Like with putting Resident Evil 2 on the N64 a bit beforehand, and what a feat that was as well. But, they kind of did this, oh, we're just going to put Resident Evil on Dreamcast, and then they went and said, oh, we're just going to put the Resident Evil games on GameCube. It was just a bit of a crazy time for Capcom, really, wasn't it?
Was a little bit, yeah, absolutely. Brian, I've not heard from you yet. Have you got any thoughts on Code Veronica?
I mean, it's no Blue Stinger, I guess.
I mean, no. What is?
I loved it at the time. I thought Code Veronica was excellent, and I have not played it in about 20 years, so there's probably a good reason I haven't chimed in. I just don't remember too much about it, other than I did play when they re-released it on the 360, just as a downloadable game. I played it a little bit then, and I can echo some of the sentiments that maybe elements of it haven't aged especially well in terms of controls, narrative. I mean, Steve Burnside is a very annoying character. but otherwise, yeah, I mean, I think it was a great game. I think it came at an interesting time, in Sega's history when they were still courting, big games like that as a tentpole release to sell the console. And so in lieu of, instead of any support from, EA and the other heavy hitters, it was kind of cool that they at least got Capcom to be as involved with exclusives as it was. And I think that's part of the enduring legacy of the console in general.
Absolutely. Yeah, very true. All right, well, because I was so unprepared, I don't know the title of the track that I'm going to tell you, but I know that it was the Save Room theme. It probably is called Save Room Theme, but have a listen, and then we'll come back in a second. Thank you. polls should be up if I'm being good. If you're listening on Radio Sega when this is broadcasting, polls should be up now. There'll be two polls, one for Dreamcast Years, one for Dreamcast Junkyard, and basically just need to figure out which game from those two is going to compete against each other. So keep an eye out. I'll put that up for a few days. If you're listening to this in the future, the poll's gone. It's too late. You can't vote. It's just far too late.
And remember, if you're not voting for Spirit of Speed, it's just because you can't handle it. So as long as that's on your conscience, that's cool.
Just to go around, just before we finish, if you could vote for anybody else's game, so you can't vote for your own, but you could vote for somebody else's, whose game would you vote for? Let's go round the room. James, whose game would you vote for if you can't vote for your own?
I would probably vote for Metropolis Street Racer.
Lovely. Steve?
I don't know. I just want to say I feel bad for dumping on Shenmue 2 earlier, Lewis. That was a very good pitch. Can you just remind me, what's that Japanese word again?
Kusoge. Okay, Kusoge.
And that means
shitty game.
Okay, cool. All right. one of the Shenmues, maybe? I don't know.
Okay. Well, thanks for being so decisive. Brian, which would you pick?
I mean, I guess Shenmue 2 is the obvious, the closest to what I picked. So I don't know, Lewis. I'm actually very interested in playing Headhunter now. So that, just because I haven't played it and now I'm very interested in. That's like kind of moved a few notches up my list of to play.
Awesome. Jason, what would you pick?
I think I was going to, before James's pitch, I probably would have chosen Headhunter. But after that pitch, mate, I'm all in for Spirit of Speed. Wow. I'm going for it, man. That's what I'd go for.
You've converted somebody, James. How does it feel?
I've converted plenty of people around Spirit of Speed over the last couple of years, mate, I think.
On a podcast, though, it must be a first.
Yeah, maybe.
Lewis, what game would you pick?
I think that everyone did brilliant pitches. It's got to be Spirit of Speed, isn't it? And if you want to hear James go on about Spirit of Speed for more than a minute, he went on about it for an hour and a half on our YouTube channel. So it is actually like genuinely fascinating. Like, that's the thing. Like, I was speaking about Kusoge. It's like there's an abundance of articles online that just kind of talk about shit games and why, you know.
It's not a shit game, though. Let's just not mix words.
he convinced me that it's a, I don't know, what's like slightly above shit.
Maybe it's not such a continuum. I don't know. I mean, I feel like the worst thing a game can be, whether it's shitty or not, the worst thing a game can be is risk adverse. Like, if it doesn't do anything interesting or new or try to at least spice up the medium with some sort of idea or innovation, like, I think that is the most damning thing you could say about any game. And I would not say it about Spirit of Speed. I think that the strict period piece that it was going for in trying to, just depict this racing as it was 80 years ago or whatever, however math works at this point. And it's just, yeah, I don't know. I think there's something very charming to that. I'd also give a shout out to Mike Phelan's Flag article that dives into all of the flags that were, how it like painstakingly represented the flags for all the countries at the time. Its historic perspective seems to be pretty impressive in its attention to detail. LJN, I think, did their homework and they should be commended. I think that, yeah, I respect it, even if it's not my type of racing game.
Lovely. All right. Well, I mean, this has just become the Spirit of Speed podcast at this point, right?
Mission accomplished.
Do you all own loads of sealed copies of that or something that you want to increase the value of on eBay? Is that what's going on here?
Steve, shut up.
I tell you what, you laugh, but there only being 87 copies sold in Japan. The Japanese copies are like 100 odd quid nowadays to try and get one off eBay.
Wow. There you go. I'd probably go, if I was gonna pick one, it's a tosser between Metropolis Drift Racer and Shenmue for me. But it'd probably be Shenmue, I reckon. So
They're all good.
And Headhunter as well is fun. It's hard to choose. I mean, these are just our pitches. Those are the six games that we've pitched. I mean, anybody listening, whether you're listening through Radio Sega or if you're listening on Dreamcast Years through our feed, feel free to let us know what your favorite Dreamcast game is and why, either on the Radio Sega Discord if you're listening right now, or come over to the Dreamcast Years Discord or find us on Twitter, wherever you want to go. Just let us know what your favorite Dreamcast game is and why. Please have a vote as well if you're in time to vote. It'd be great to see what wins. It's probably going to be Spirit of Speed now, if I feel like that's just the way this is going. So we'll see. We will see. All right, let's leave it there. Thank you so much, everybody. Thank you, Radio Sega listeners. And I hope you are enjoying Winterfest and whatever comes next you're going to enjoy. Before we go, let's go around and just see where everybody is and where you can find them. James, where can people find you?
You can find me on Twitter at Agile Harvey, where I will be inevitably talking about Spirit of Speed and motor racing in general
for the rest of time. Brian, where can people find you?
I'm on Twitter at VirtuousLub. I also, if it's okay, I want to plug something near and dear to my heart for the Saturn Junkyard. We are celebrating the 15th anniversary of that website. It's the blog, which of course we have the podcast, the Titancast, which I host, and then we have the YouTube channel, we got the blog still, we have a Facebook group, so definitely want to plug all of that. But as part of this 15th anniversary competition we're doing, we're actually having kind of a contest where people can submit whatever they're basically any form of art that they want to, whether it's a drawing or songs or videos or written pieces or recorded pieces, just kind of celebrating the Sega Saturn and its impact on gaming and on people, just our experience personally with the medium. So I just want to shout that out. I think we're going for a while. We're gonna start judging entries in February. There are prizes. We have had quite a few people in the community donate things, so we're actually giving away a variety of art pieces, but and other things, but a console as well, a custom console, I believe, and a few other things that you could win. So keep an eye out for that. I think the details are on the Facebook group, the Saturn Junkyard, and then we'll probably shoot it out to Twitter and other things. Entries, I think you can just send them to thesaturnjunkyard@gmail.com. that's how we'll collect them. So that's it.
Awesome. Sounds good.
Congratulations on reaching 15 years.
Yeah, thanks.
I mean, there were about give or take 8 or 9 of those that, it was just in stasis a bit. So, I like to say 15 years of existence and 7 years of excellence. But it's probably been more than that. But yeah, no, it's good times. It's been a lot of fun being part of that community. I love being part of it and all the stuff that and cool ideas and good people that I've met over that time.
Amazing. Awesome. Lewis, where can we find you? And can you tell us a little bit about where to find the Dreamcast Junkyard as well?
Yep. So you can find me at Twitter at LewisJFC. And you can find the Dreamcast Junkyard at www.thedreamcastjunkyard.co.uk. There's links on that for basically all of our social media, such as Facebook, our YouTube channel, our podcast, The Dream Pod, our Twitch. The Twitter handle is at the DC Junkyard, which is where we tend to be most active. Me and Mike, shit posting our way to, victory. And we've been quite busy on the blog recently, so that's exciting. I think it's just like a, I don't know, it must be a Christmas thing, because we all seem to be sort of like, you know, winding down for the year, just thinking of ways to, you know, write, you know, cool articles and stuff and contributing. So, yeah, that's exciting. So, yeah, check us out. We're going to have a lot more things coming, including episode 100 of the Dream Pod. So mega exciting. That was recorded the other day, yesterday, I believe, actually, and wrapped up. And James knows all about that because he was on it. But we're kind of like keeping it under wraps. But if you want to check our Discord, there's a photo that we put up on there of what went on. So a bit of a sneak peek.
Yeah, very excited for that. And we've got the other half of that episode to record still, don't we? So please do. There's if you go to the at the DC Junkyard on Twitter, I think we've asked for submissions. So please do submit. By the time this goes out, hopefully, I think we should still be accepting them. But if not, it might be too late. And if you are, that's fine. But please listen to episode 100 because it's going to be awesome.
Yeah, it's like if you want to record yourself to be on the podcast, ask us a question, give us a nice message or share a memory. That's what we're doing currently. So it's a link that we've been sharing. So have a look for that.
Indeed. Absolutely. Cool. And also we have it's a buymeacoffee.com/DC Junkyard, I believe. If you want to buy a VMU battery for the Dreamcast Junkyard team.
Yeah, that's that. Yeah, buymeacoffee.com/DC Junkyard. Yeah, that's the one.
Lovely. Steve.
Yes, you cannot find me on Twitter right now. I'm currently interneting in incognito mode, but you can find me on the Dreamcast Years podcasts.
Indeed. Very true. Awesome. Jason, where can we find you?
You can find me on Twitter at GamerJasonUK, and also you can find me and Rich do a podcast called What's Wrong with Wolfie, which is our podcast based on the 1990s, where we're going through TVs, shows, movies, and video games. And we recently had a special guest, and that was you, wasn't it, Andrew?
It was, yeah.
Yes. Was so our 1995 TV show episode featured the good Andrew himself, and we're just trying to get through the 90s and just have a chat about all the great films and TV shows of the time.
Yeah, great podcast it is too. So go and have a look. So what's the Twitter handle for that, sorry?
Yes, that is at the Wolfie Pod.
Awesome. Go take a look. You can find me at Oddment84 on Twitter. You can find the Dreamcast, the Dreamcast Junkyard. We've already gone through that. You can find Dreamcast Years at Dreamcast Years, and you can go to dreamcastyears.co.uk, where you can find the podcast. You can also find the first book, which is Dreamcast Year One, which you can buy digitally, and the first zine that we've done, which is DCY, as well, it's called DCY, which you can also buy a copy of digitally if you so wish. We're also on Buy Me a Coffee, which is buymeacoffee.com/Dreamcast Years, where you can throw us some money. We've not been clever like the Dreamcast Junkyard. We're not saying you can buy us a VMU battery. We're literally just saying you can buy us a cup of coffee, because we're not that clever. So please, if you enjoy what we're doing, go and chuck us a few quid. It would be much appreciated. But yeah, and other than that, you can also find myself at Lost in Cult, where we're producing the Lock On Gaming Journal. We've just shipped volume 2, and volume 3, which is coming very, very, very soon, is going to be Dreamcast themed. It's going to be a Dreamcast special, so very topical for this particular episode. So please follow us along at Lost in Cult on Twitter to be informed when the campaign for volume 3 is going to be up and running. All righty, that's enough plugging. Let's end it there. Thank you so much, everybody. Thank you for joining me, guys. It's been a lot of fun to chat to you all.
Thank you, Andrew.
Thank you very much. And anybody listening, please do vote. And again, happy Winterfest. And thank you very much for having us on Radio Sega for a lovely joint episode between the Dreamcast Junkyard and Dreamcast Years. Had a lot of fun. Until next time, see you later. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.